Well, good afternoon and welcome. And today is Tuesday, February 21st, 2017. Broadcasting on both VeteransToday.com and on FreedomSlips.com. FreedomSlips.com, Studio B Revolution Radio. Today is going to be sort of a unique and very special show because Jim Dean is on here going to co-host with me. And we've got two guests today, the first one being Terry Benedict. And so those of you who are not familiar with who Terry is, he did a documentary film on called The Conscientious Objector, a documentary on this guy, Doss, who was really the featured character in the Hacksaw Ridge movie. So, Jim, welcome to the show. Terry, welcome to the show. Gentlemen, where do you want to start?
Well, I thought I
at
would
at the beginning.
Yeah.
Oh, I love it. I love it. Yeah. Ask a stupid question, get a stupid answer.
I wanted to have Terry Benedict when the publicity people for Hacksaw contacted me about doing an interview. Of course, we said sure. But then I quickly looked down the list, the longest producers, and I was hoping, I said, gosh, I hope they didn't steal this thing from Terry Benedict, who did all that work to do the documentary. So I was happy when I saw his name in there as producer. I said, I just assumed that great, they had worked off of his original work, which he's going to tell us about tonight. And folks, you've all heard about Hacksaw Ridge coming out this fall. Well, what's they're sponsoring now is they have the home media, the 4K and the DVD coming out actually today, I think it was. So they're doing a big rollout on that. So the movie's been out, and we are going to cover a little bit about the story. But I wanted to really focus in on what you're really not going to get, because the internet's filled with the trailers, and you'll be able to see get the flavor for the incredible story. But we're going to focus on this hour is how something like this gets made. The number of little miracles that have to be strung together. And this one started when an independent filmmaker at the time decided that this story really needed a documentary. And when I was talking to Terry last night doing a pre-interview, he really kind of floored me. He told me that the first time he got started with Desmond Doss, he met him when he was 12 years old. So I'll let you start there, Terry, on the beginning of you and Desmond Doss that led to doing this, your documentary many years later, and to have a Best Picture Emmy-nominated motion picture film.
Well, you know, I start feeling really old when I think back at that. This actually started when I was 10 years old. My parents didn't let us kids grow up with a television, and they wanted us to learn to read and read a lot, and or go outside and play kick the can or something. So I actually came across, like most boys, you know, you start reading about hero stories and books on World War II. So I read the canon of World War II books, you know, 30 Seconds Over Tokyo or Guadalcanal Diary, Pearl Harbor, all that sort of stuff. And then I came across this book called The Unlikeliest Hero. And it was a story about a guy that, I mean, it was just, I had never heard of such a thing happening. A man who wouldn't carry a gun during World War II, and he joined the army anyway because he wanted to be a combat medic. And he had this passion for wanting to serve when he had a legitimate deferment. And then the guys harassed him. They gave him nothing but trouble, abused him. It got really ugly for 2.5 years. And then the twist of fate happens where the company of men go up on this ridge, this cliff called Hacksaw Ridge in Okinawa, the big final battle before jumping off to mainland Japan near the end of the war. And 155 men in his company went up the cliff, and only 35 came back under their own power when they got pushed off by the Japanese. Many were dead up there, but he was credited with lowering 75 wounded men, the men that had hated him so much, and they fell in love with him and recommended him for the Medal of Honor. So my little 10-year-old brain was really trying to do the math on that and wrap itself around the concept of it all. And then when I was 12, I did get to meet Desmond at a church summer camp, and that was quite an impressionable event for me in my life as well. So that's how it started.
Well, then many years later, you got into the film business, went to Pepperdine University, I think, and started out, worked on a Terminator. But share with the readers, because I know that the independent film production is a very, very tough and very competitive business these days. How did you get the idea of, because I heard that Desmond had really turned down any commercialization of his story. Share with us how that event came, where you and he hooked up, and obviously he'd been approached by a lot of producers and had always turned them down.
Well, that part I didn't know at the time, of course, until I reconnected with Desmond in the late 90s, and that's when I found out that he had been saying no to Hollywood since 1945 when he got the medal. And his two primary concerns were, one, that he didn't want to be glorified. He wanted that to go to God. And the second thing was that he was concerned that Hollywood might try to spice up his character. And I don't know why he would think that, but that was his two concerns. And so he had always said no. His sands of time were getting pretty thin, you know, even then in the late 90s. And we met at a Medal of Honor reunion, and I really got to see how those heroes really set Desmond apart in a very positive, reverent way. Because, in fact, they appointed him their chaplain several times. And so I talked to Desmond a lot about how I felt that there were universal themes in his role modeling that could be very inspirational and be very beneficial to the rest of mankind. And so he kept voicing these concerns to me. And finally, one day I was visiting him down in Chattanooga, and we were standing outside a grocery store, and he was talking to me about it again. And I said, Desmond, I said, I really do understand it. And I said, here's what I can promise you, that I'll answer to God first, you second, and everybody else can get in line. And he got a big grin on his face and started laughing. And he said, okay, all right, you can do it. And by that point, we had gotten to know each other well enough. I joked with him about, you know, how I felt a documentary really needed to be done because he wasn't going to live forever. And he'd laugh and he'd say, what do you mean that I'm not going to? And I said, yeah, I said, at some point you're going to kick the bucket. And I said, the only history is the Medal of Honor citation, and it reads like a big fish story. And after you're gone, nobody's going to believe it. And he would just laugh and he'd say, yeah, you're probably right. I said, we need to find whoever's left, whoever had shared war experience with you. We need to get to them now. And so that was the strategy, to do the documentary first, and then the movie certainly could come later. And the other thing was, really needed to discover really what Desmond's war experience story was like. And even reading the book way back then, it was very thin on details in the story. So I knew there was a lot more there, and the documentary certainly brought out a lot of color, a lot of facts that were never known. And that's what Hacksaw ended up being based on. So it was a very long journey. It took a lot longer than I thought. It took almost 4 years. I took some of the vets with Desmond over to Okinawa. And that was a very moving experience for everybody, and especially me, because I separated the guys out and I took them one by one to the top of Hacksaw, and I immediately started filming them and getting their reaction to this was the first time they had ever seen this place since the hellishness of back then in May of 45. So it was an experience that was truly an honor for me to go through with these guys. As we've all heard, you know, that generation never shared any of their war experience. Their families didn't know anything really about them or what they sacrificed, what they went through. And that was a very gratifying aspect, that these families finally could hear these guys give it all up. They were ready to let go. They knew time was short. In fact, one of Desmond's commanding officers died 2 weeks after I interviewed him. He had called me and said, "Terry, I think you should come now." And so I think it was very cathartic for them. It was great for their families to find out finally what had happened. And for Desmond, it was something that he had told his story so long and so often in a very rote way, but this time he went back and relived it in a way that even for him, he finally could put at rest some things that had bothered him. And I can't even believe from a 10-year-old kid it came back around to me like this. It's just unbelievable.
And you also had the very good luck. I saw in one of your earlier interviews that you had the Pentagon help you try to run down some of the people that had had contact with them. You came up with a list of 5,000, and you only found seven or eight that they were able to locate. So, and really, that added a major dimension to your documentary. That without that, you wouldn't have able to have that that extra punch of those other eyewitnesses, the men who had been involved in harassing Desmond and referring to him as a coward, also reflecting. And folks, besides seeing Hacksaw Ridge, you must see the documentary, because the miss out on not hearing Desmond telling his story and these men who were there, you'll be missing a major part of this story. But how did... once you got the, what was the initial reception when you went out to start screening Desmond's story for the conscientious objector?
Well, we did our world premiere up at the Cinequest Film Festival in San Jose in 04 is when I finished it. And that was ranked number 10 in the world, that film festival at the time. And I actually was really concerned, if not outright scared, because that's the Bay Area. I knew there were some very eclectic and edgy hip films, documentaries that we were competing with. And they had asked us to be the final gala event at the awards show. And so our film had not even screened during the festival at that point.
Wow.
And we ended up, the line to see the film was around the block and down the street. They had to add a second screening, and we did really well. You know, we're very blessed with the awards for a two-year period on the film festival circuit. We did incredibly well. And I really believe that the reason why people really responded to a World War II history documentary was because it was very pure and unadulterated storytelling. And you really got to hear these men emote in ways that 80 and 90 year old men with, you know, telling things that they were either afraid of, ashamed of, or crying, you know, or laughing. I mean, you got to see these men who are grandfathers, you know, or even great grandfathers really be human at a most basic level, and that people really responded to. And I really think that's why. And the Desmond story, of course, was just unbelievably amazing what happened up on that ridge. And without sort of a total spoiler alert, when you save 75 men in a 12-hour period, that's one man every 10 minutes about. And for a 155-pound man who's very slight build, to be able to do that, it's physically impossible. And so there were things that happened on that hill that were miraculous. There's just no other way to explain it.
Well, he was lucky, and he was lucky to have had a young boy who read his book. And Hollywood, when they asked you to approach him, they picked the right guy, and everything really came together, including being able to add those extra finding some of those men, because that dimension would have been gone forever. I've experienced the same thing with some of these old guys, that the trick is, if you can just get them going, you reach a point sometimes within 5 minutes that it's almost like the floodgates open. and they'll go on for hours. And I think in my notes here, I've got said you were literally interrogating these guys for 8 to 10 hours a day in their homes when you went out to interview them.
Well, and I wish that most of them would have been, you know, as easy as getting 5 minutes in and then they were rocking. But they really had to be given permission in a way that spoke in some ways, like, not to get all psychological, but really spoke to their inner child, their inner little boy in there, and give that little boy permission to talk, because that's where all the emotions were held down in there. And I think that once they did get that permission, once they did get going and felt comfortable, then it just poured out of them like the dam is broken. And it was, I never knew what was going to happen when Carl Bentley, who was a judge in Texas, we took him to Okinawa, and he was talking about how there was a wounded GI in one of the Japanese caves that was wounded, and he and his buddy, the guy was moaning and groaning, and he, his buddy, had thought about putting the guy out of his misery so the Japanese wouldn't find them. And he's telling this story on camera, and it's so riveting. And then he finishes, and he looks away, and he says, I'm ashamed I even thought of doing that. And it was incredibly humbling to be a part of that process, because I knew that it was history in the making for each one of these men to be able to share what they went through. And I never took that for granted. And what's been interesting, because the documentary now is, we're in 17, so it's 13 years old now that it's been out. And I still get people finding my phone or calling me up saying, I can't believe I never knew this story, and I can't believe how it's impacted my life. I'm making life changes because of this documentary. And also that started to happen now since Hacksaw Ridge has come out. And that's the most grateful thing a filmmaker could ever hear, was that he's touched the audience in a way that he was hoping to do. And for me, I know that's what Desmond wanted to see. And I know that he would have been really, really happy with that kind of impact and feedback.
Well, I know Desmond was really not well known throughout the country. Typically, other than youth groups, his church, and the Medal of Honor Society, that's primarily where he kind of went out and did talks on. But I saw in some of my notes, you, as part of you taking him to the Pentagon to do a tour. And you said it was one of your memories was that even though Desmond was in civilian clothes, as soon as his name was mentioned, you were watching Four Stars generals saluting him. They knew instantly who he was.
Yeah, that was a total shock for me. This happened literally just before 9/11. And we walked in, and I was going to meet a rear admiral that I had met before, and we were going to talk about Desmond's story. And walking down the hallway, several of these high brass military people, multi-star generals, they would stop and they would look at him, making sure that's who he was. And they would stop, and Desmond would stop, and they would immediately salute him. And he's just wearing civvies. And I didn't know what was going on. And then they couldn't say enough kind things about him and how honored they were to meet him. And it just was a complete surprise. But these men had come to know and value the way that Desmond made a contribution and understood the dynamic and the cultural change that Desmond actually caused by serving the way that he did.
The you mentioned one of the little phrase that caught my attention, that getting a great movie out is something like capturing light in a bottle, and that you felt you had been able to do that. with all those experiences that you not only saw live yourself, but you were able to share those on film. As you look back on it now, I guess you realize, you know, it probably changed your whole life in terms of where you're going to go on from here. And part of that is, tell us a little bit about your Shays Foundation, which you named after your daughter, didn't you?
Yeah, that's her middle name. It's Old Gaelic. It means gifted and learned. And after meeting Desmond and finishing the documentary, I saw the effects that the film was having on people in the audience, and some people much wiser than me came to me and said, you really ought to consider doing more documentaries and films that have a message to them. And I gave it a little bit of thought, but it really started to gnaw on me after a while. And I thought, well, if there's a way that somebody could give back, I wanted to be able to be part of that process. So basically, Shay's mission and reason to exist, its purpose, is to create message media for other nonprofits that can't afford to tell their story in a way that would raise awareness and help them better achieve their mission. And then we also focus on specific causes. For instance, sex trafficking in Nepal is one of the things that we're very much are involved with. Native American education and some of the things that wrongs that need to be righted in that community. And then there's something, I'm getting ready to go to Africa actually next week for a couple of weeks, an initiative called the Global Women's Health Initiative that helps women with pelvic floor dysfunction, three areas there that I'm dealing with some world-class women in the medical world, and we're going to raise awareness for the things that go on in, around the world, including the United States, things like uterine prolapse and fistula and genital mutilation, three things that aren't so pretty to talk about. But you know, there's a thing that if there's a healthy, happy woman, then that means the village and the community will also be thriving. And that includes, there's places even here in America that women have some severe challenges in terms of PFD. So we're hoping that that this will kick off a new awareness campaign that will really bring to light what women go through, and they shouldn't. These are all things that are resolvable, that don't need to happen.
Amen. We've got just a couple minutes for the break, so I'll go over in the hacksaw, and we may have to carry some of it over the break, but the number one thing of getting a film going like that is you have to have a script, and someone had to purchase the story rights at some point. Was that the first step in jumpstarting getting the movie started?
Well, when I had gotten both the documentary and theatrical rights from Desmond, had at that point in his life had given or donated his intellectual property rights to his local church conference. So that came through that pipeline, but I had gotten the theatrical rights at the same time as the documentary. And so that's why when I was in the midst of post-production on the documentary, I started talking to various producers and production companies about who would make sense to pair up with to start developing the feature. And so David Permit, a producer in town, introduced me to Bill Mechanic, who is the former president of production of 20th Century Fox during the Castaway Titanic days. And I really liked Bill's vibe and understanding of the importance of Desmond's story, the uniqueness, and also the essential prerequisite to protect the integrity of Desmond's faith and his relationship and his character. And so Bill got that.
Okay, well, Jim, we're up against our break here. Terry, everyone just hang on. We'll be back in a couple of minutes after about a 3 or 4 minute short break. So we'll be right back after this. Stick with us, folks. Good afternoon. Welcome back. This is Mike Harris broadcasting on VeteransToday.com, also on FreedomSlips.com, Studio B, Revolution Radio. Today is Tuesday, February 21st, 2017. This is a special show. I guess Jim Dean is really hosting, and I'm just sitting here listening and learning. But I want to welcome back Jim Dean and Terry Benedict. And Terry, I too am a graduate of Pepperdine University, so wanted to toss
all
that
All right.
In. So,
away.
Go Waves. That's right.
Right. One of my exec producers on Hacksaw, David Greathouse, he's also a graduate of Pepperdine. So we're pulling together here to make some films.
Well, that Malibu campus is probably one of those beautiful places on the entire West Coast.
I mean, well, it's just a quick little gorgeous ditty. My first job in Hollywood came as a result of me lifeguarding at the pool at Pepperdine. The Academy Award winning cinematographer Haskell Wexler worked out at the pool there, and his producer was there. And so while I was lifeguarding, they found out what my major was, and they gave me my first job coming out of school.
Well, hey, there you go. You know, like you don't go to Pepperdine for the education, you go there for the network.
That's right. Or not for the sunsets.
Yeah. Anyway, Jim, this is your show here, buddy, so take it away.
What a small world it is, you know. We cross kind of path. But the reason I wanted to segue in through that door is because once you have the rights path kind of established and you got shopping around, I think the next step is getting a screenplay done. And then I'm going to ask you, then we'll move on to casting. But that was the next big step. And then I share with the audience a little bit about what goes on in trying to find the right person and how many stages just getting a screenplay done, because that's what you're going to use to start shopping for casting, and then also for an eventual funder to put up the money to go into production.
Right. Well, there are a variety of steps, and all of it can be rather time consuming, and you try to do things in a timely way. I think one of the best analogies is if you think of a jigsaw puzzle, the canvas has a picture that we want to put together. And the unique difference about creating a film is the pieces aren't already pre-cut. You have to cut them and get them to fit together. And as time goes by, as you're developing your project, the shapes change, because an actor may be available and then becomes unavailable, or they may, scheduling-wise, not work out with the director that you'd like to see happen. So there's a lot of fluidness that ends up happening when you're developing a film project. And then there's also a dynamic that you have absolutely no control over, including the narrative and the mood of the public. You know, what kind of films are they looking to go see, and what's happening out in the world, and world events and local events and subject matter that are thematics that are going around the world. And so it's a very complex web that you're trying to work your way through. And so no producer or filmmaker wants to take a decade or more to get their film going. It happened to us. We never anticipated that. There were a lot of reasons for that, but you know, some reasons are explainable and other things aren't. But having lived with it longer than anybody, since, you know, like we joke about being 10 years old, I think that the one thing that I've realized from this whole process is that the right filmmaker did the film, the right lead actor and the cast and the crew. They were all right. Had we done this earlier, it would have been nice to get the film done earlier, but it wouldn't have been the film that it is today. And I wouldn't change that really for even though it took so long to get made. Mel is an extraordinary filmmaker, and he, a lot of times, you know, people will talk about the graphic nature of Hacksaw, but it's about a story of a medic, and a medic's job is about cleaning up the carnage of what war does to the human body. And it's horrific. It's terrible. I think we should see this sort of thing in a way to romance it or to make it grandiose, but to sober us up a little bit, to say there's a consequence for making decisions to go into war, and they better be really good reasons why we do what we do. And on the other hand, when we go make those sacrifices, the men and women who go off to make those sacrifices and put their lives at risk, that we need to fully appreciate as much as we possibly can what they're doing, what their families are going through, and not just that they give the ultimate sacrifice, but they come home and they're scarred. Even if a bullet never hit them, they are forever changed from that experience. And I think that Desmond, when Mel balanced the graphic nature against Desmond's heroics and the way that he served, this is really about a triple love story. Desmond's love for God, Desmond's love for serving his fellow man unconditionally, and of course, the love he had for his wife, Dorothy. But the fact that this man would lay his life out like he did, there was only really one way to show that, and that was the way that Mel did it, and really forcing us to focus on the fact that some pretty horrific things happened. But in spite of that, there was white light, there was hope, and that hope was a little guy called Desmond Doss that weighed 155 pounds, and for him to do what he did, it helps us appreciate that even more. And just a quick little side note. I was, when we talk about me interrogating the guys, the first person I interviewed, of course, was Desmond. And I interviewed him 5 days straight for 8 to 10 hours a day. We started on a Monday, and by Friday, I was completely frustrated. I was really frustrated to the point that I got up out of the chair next to the camera because I was interviewing him. And I grabbed Desmond by the lapels and I started shaking him. And I said, "You are the worst storyteller on the face of the earth. You can't even tell your own story." And his wife, Frances, came running in and she said, Terry, what's wrong? What's wrong?" I realized I had just probably stepped over a line I shouldn't have done. And the moment I sat back down and, no, before I sat down, I looked him in the eyes and I said, "Desmond, I want you to tell your story from your heart and not your head." And he never blinked. He looked at me very softly and he said, "Okay." And I sat down and I'm feeling horrible. I'm feeling bad. Here's a Medal of Honor recipient, somebody who's accomplished something I shouldn't even be touching him, you know? And we rolled the camera and within just a few minutes, he was crying. He teared up and he started talking about being up on Hacksaw Ridge and feeling like he was having a nervous breakdown. And he just kept pleading with God, "Help me get one more." And that's why in the film, when you hear him say that, that's where that moment came from in that documentary. And yet, when you, Carl Bentley, who was hiding from his foxhole and watching Desmond, he said Desmond looked like he was totally at peace and going or moving around that battlefield and fearless and full of confidence. And yet inside, Desmond was totally physically, spiritually hanging on by a thread. Mentally, he was spent and he had no gas in the tank. And so when you see these moments come together like that, and you come to know a man like that, there was no romancing that was going on when Mel with Mel directing this picture like he did. It was, he wanted it to be very guttural for you to be able to feel. And that's why I think that it's easy to reminisce about, well, it would have been nice if it had taken, you know, a dozen years to finally get made. It really was about timing and making sure it was done right. And it got done right.
The, getting back to casting, of course, they really did nail it. The one quick question, did they have people cast early on that basically because of age, they got older and whatever, you had to drop and then recast it? Like for Desmond's part, was I correct in here that it took Andrew said he needed 5 years to prepare to do it?
Well, Desmond in real life was, of course, very early 20s when he went to war. So you can imagine that I'm coming out of post-production in 04 and Bill was starting development on the thing. And so somebody, if they would have been in their early 20s, you know, a dozen years later, they would age out. So that just sheer timeline wise, that would have happened anyway. But Andrew, and this is why I'm so glad about the timing, because Andrew truly is a very special human being and a incredible actor. And the way that he approaches a role, he has a process that he likes to go through, and to be able to take ownership of the character. And so that's why it was so important that he come down to Chattanooga, and then we went up to Lynchburg, Virginia. I took him there, and it was nice to be with him to go through part of that process and immerse him in everything I possibly could, in the wealth of knowledge and information and experience that I had with Desmond. I just wanted to be as open as I possibly could and share everything that he wanted to know and give him as much color as possible. And that's why you want an actor who's going to approach things like that and not just have it as a gig. You really want somebody who is going to play 100%, not just for the time he's playing, but for in perpetuity, because this film will be, has a timeless feature to it. It will become,
absolutely,
I believe, a classic.
Yes, absolutely.
And that's because of the work these guys put into it.
They did, and you mentioned that the same was true for Dorothy, his wife. And the biggest compliment I saw for that when the son was being interviewed, and they were asking him about the casting, and when they got to Dorothy doing the mother, he just shook his head and he says it was just unbelievable to see how she pulled that off. And he started crying also because he said she had just really nailed. He says it was almost like, you know, my mother having come back. I was just astounded.
Yeah, Teresa had this touch that you just fell in love with her softness, her caringness. And even Rachel Griffith, who played, you know, Desmond's mom, she had this also. Desmond was imbued with this unconditional love principle, and that came from his mother. And it didn't certainly come from his father. His father was very tough on the boys, and he had issues going on. Desmond's mom was the one really bringing home the bacon, so to speak, most of the time during the Depression. And the love that Bertha, Desmond's mom, was able to instill was that if you were truly going to have and claim to have a relationship with God, a faith walk, and be an authentic Christian, the way that you showed that was manifesting it in your willingness to serve others unconditionally. And so that's why, whether you see it in the documentary or you see it in Hacksaw, where he walks 5 miles to donate blood, and then he turned around and did it again the very next day because he heard there was a car wreck that happened. That can only come from a child learning at a very young age a very core principle of life, which is what his mom taught him about living a faith walk and having a relationship with God. And that's very unusual. It's certainly uneven unusual in today's times, of course. And that's why I think the story, as I used to tell Desmond, has universal themes that we can benefit from, is that some themes are timeless. And so anyway, I got off in the weeds there a little bit with you, but yes, I mean, the actors for sure committed 100% and did their homework. And that's all you can ask of them as a producer or a filmmaker.
Well, they did a home run, and they have something to hang on the wall that they're always going to be proud of. With the time we've got left, I wanted to talk a little bit about the other end, the end of the movie, which is the editing, the music, the second unit, because you ended up going and having, I think it was, I had to squeeze the budget down from $80 million to $40 million because that was the feasible number that was available for financing, and you had to shoot the combat scenes in Australia. Can you tell us a little bit in the time we've got left about all of the tremendous workings there and working with Australians, of all of the pyrotechnics and the scenes and the combat scenes being shot there?
Well, the whole film was done in Australia. That was primarily because Screen Australia helped fund the film. And so that was one of the prerequisites for filming down there. So there's several parts to your question. In terms of the effects and that sort of thing, we obviously live in a world where there's a lot of CGI, and which means nothing's real for the most part. And we didn't necessarily have that luxury, nor did we. It would have been nice, but you don't always have to have that sort of thing. So a lot of what happened was in traditional Hollywood filmmaking, physical effects. For instance, when you see an explosion go off and there's fire, it's real. There's heat there. If you're standing there, you feel the heat. You see the guy with the flamethrower. That's real. And, you know, the stunt guys are being set on fire. Hollywood's been doing this for obviously decades. But Mel's approach and Simon Dugan, the DP, they certainly captured, I think, in a fresh way, the not just the graphicness of it, but a perspective that was done in a way that lets you feel like you're there and that you're participating in the experience. And I think that that's important. Things, again, in terms of the second unit, they were terrific. A lot of, obviously, physical stunts going on, what we call air rams with cables where guys get, you know, thrown and blown and that sort of thing. So a lot of the traditional ways that Hollywood used to do things, we did, and nothing wrong with that. In some ways it offers more textural, authentic nature to it. So the effects coordinator, the stunt coordinator, the second unit coordinator, makeup effects, the makeup crew was terrific. I used to spend a fair amount of time with them and watching them to be consistent day after day after day, putting the actor in the same makeup of being war-torn. That's not an easy trick to do. And it takes diligence, takes a thoroughness. And I think that you couldn't ask more from the crew. They played the game 100% as well. Never heard, you know, any of the dynamics sometimes you hear in Hollywood going on. Everybody worked together as a well-oiled machine, and everybody was respectful as artists. They just were great. It was a dream. What was the other part of your question?
I was going to just move on now into the big, we're getting toward the end. And that is, once you got all the pieces together, it had to go in to edit. And is everyone sitting around waiting until that's done? Do those folks, or are you seeing partial edits, or do you have to wait and see until it's all done to see, you know, how all of this worked? When was the first time where you saw the end run of the whole movie?
Well, all of that was done down under. So I was not down there for that. Bill Mechanic, my producing partner, he was the one that was spent the time on a daily basis with John Gilbert and the rest of the editorial team, and obviously Mel, and then of course the rest of the post-production team was also, you know, kicking in. And so Bill was really the one leading the charge through all of that. And the first time I saw the film was the rough cut, the director's rough cut, Mel's rough cut. And at that point, there's no effects in there. Whatever effects were going to get put in weren't in there. You're looking at it for content purposes. Is the story holding together? Is it playing well? What's the pace like? Those types of things. And when I sat in Bill's office watching it, when it was over, it felt fast. It felt like the pace was great. And I was emotionally moved by it. And that's what you want, is if you can get emotive in a rough cut, then you're for sure going to be definitely emotive when the film is finished, when it has all the music and all that kind of thing. And so again, I can't give enough kudos to Mel being an extraordinary filmmaker and the team that he chose to put together, and Kevin O'Connell, who was the sound, he's nominated now. He's known as sort of the Susan Lucci because he's been nominated so many times, like 20 plus times. Yeah. And he was truly an amazing sound engineer. So it just was a lot of people that were really exceptionally gifted coming together and doing their roles and playing to the hilt with them.
Well, we thank you, sir.
Well, Terry, thank you very much for joining us. We are out of time. This is the top of the hour. And folks, we have to take another short break. We'll be back in a few minutes. We will have another guest right after this. Stick around.
Thank you, Terry.